Welcome to Real Estate Pro Tips and Strategies. The theme is how to buy a home or sell a home in a changing real estate market. Hi, my name is Pete Sabine, and I'm here with my team partner, Leslie Whitney. We are real estate professionals with Compass and the 5-star real estate team here in the San Francisco Bay Area. We want to share with you our real estate expertise to give you a competitive edge and provide insight with useful information so you can make an informed decision for your next home purchase. Leslie and I break down the most important aspects of real estate. Let's begin our podcast.
Welcome.
Hi there, I'm Bill Freeborn from Golden One Credit Union in the Home Loan Group, and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the various mortgage programs that can help home buyers, whether they're a first-time home buyer or trying to move from one home to a next home, and some other examples like that.
So great.
Let's jump on in.
Okay. I'm Pete Sabine with Compass Real Estate, and this is Leslie Whitney.
Hello.
So first off, I want to just jump into sort of a recap of the things we're going to cover. Talk mortgage interest rate buy-downs. Buy-downs can come in a temporary form or a permanent form, and essentially what that means is you can buy down the rate for a year or two, or you can have it be bought down for the entire term of the loan. Sometimes in today's world with higher interest rates and the prospect of rates dropping lower, we tend to not do too many permanent buy-downs just because the idea is in a year or two, we'll be able to get that same buy-down for nothing. We'll talk about, for sellers, the idea of price reductions and or credits, and whether we want to, and how does that impact capital gain? Because the discount you have on your home, if you've owned your home for a long time, won't actually be the full discount. Negotiations with lower purchase prices versus interest rate buy-downs, briefly talked about. Creating buyer competition when selling your home. Creative financing options to buy your next home. And then you guys will jump into the want to know.
Right. Okay.
All right. So mortgage interest rate buy-downs, temporary rate buy-down. So what does it really mean? It means you can lower your interest rate for 1, 2, or 3 years. This is in a situation where the seller wants to give credits instead of dropping the price, and you can use those credits to buy down the interest rate. So as an example, if an interest rate today is at 6.5, for 1 year you could have it be 5.5 with those credits, and you can do it for 2 years, and it buys down 2% in the first year and 1% in the second year. And I will preface with all these things we talk about, you're going to need some extra time to absorb all this, and that's where you call me and we can talk through it in more detail.
Yeah, if you click to the next slide, it goes into a little more depth on the difference between the temporary and the permanent, right?
Exactly. Buyer still qualifies at the full market rate instead of the discounted rate. That's an important piece to know. Is that, yes, while you'll have a lower payment in the first year, you still have to qualify based on the normal interest rate. Temporary buy-downs in general are for conforming loans, which for our high-cost area, that means up to $1,089,000 in loan amount. The discount fees for these buy-downs must be paid by the seller. It's not something you can opt to do on your own. And an escrow account, buyer can receive a refund in essence. So any buy down that you do, if you do a refinance within the period in which the rate is bought down, those funds that haven't been used, in essence the discounted interest rate, you'll get back in the form of a credit against your payoff when you're requesting your payoff statement.
So in other words, if the seller paid $20,000 up front to buy down the rate, and it's a 2-year buy down, and you get past the first year and the buyer decides, well, I want to refinance now, and there's any money left in that escrow account for that $20,000 that hasn't been used, then that goes back to the buyer, and the buyer can then pay loan fees if they want to refinance.
Yeah, exactly. And in simple math terms, if you say the remaining amount of the buy down that hasn't been used is $10,000 and your balance is $1,010,000, the payoff that you'll get from your lender is going to say $1 million. And in essence, which Pete brings up a good point, the buy-down is really an escrow account is created on behalf of you, which is why the note rate is still whatever the normal note rate is,
and there's a little bit of money coming out of that account every single month to pay the difference of the normal rate versus the bought down rate.
Until you've used up all that money, and usually that's the end of the 2 year or the 3 year temporary term, and then it goes all the way up to the full rate thereafter.
Exactly.
So that's the difference with between a permanent buy down, where when you buy it down, it stays at the discounted rate forever from day one, versus this just being temporary.
Exactly. And you'll notice too, if you have a loan like this, when you sign the note is going to be at the full price and full rate, but then there's an addendum that speaks to the buy down. Exactly. Permanent rate buy down, it reduces the interest rate, also refer for life of the loan, and it's referred to as discount points, meaning if your interest rate is without points is 6%, maybe you can buy it down to 5.75 or 5.5, and you pay a fee up front, and when you spend that fee, you've spent that fee. It's an expense, and there's no getting it back down the road.
So let's talk about what points mean. So 1 point equals 1% of the loan amount that you're borrowing. So if you're borrowing $500,000, 1 point is $5,000.
Exactly.
Okay. And then so those points that you're paying, and when you're shopping for an interest rate and you're calling around, you're on the internet and you're seeing the advertised rate at say 6%. In most cases, is that what you would assume to be without paying any points, any loan fees?
I think what you'll find is, especially in an advertising, and even if you go onto a national bank website and you search out rates, there's going to be discount points involved, and it'll disclose it somewhere perhaps in the fine print, or it'll just be disclosed in the APR. So when you see some interest rate that's really, really low, you need to dig into whether there's discount points or not. Again, as I'd referenced earlier, in today's world, where we've really seen it in the last week, the interest rate market has been volatile. And if rates drop in a year from now, buying down a rate isn't necessarily practical, because if you paid a point or 2 points and bought down a rate, you might be able to get that same rate for free in a year or two from now. However, as we'll notice in the next point, when it speaks to sometimes you need to buy down the rate because it's what's required to be able to qualify from a debt to income ratio. And sometimes that's the difference of qualifying for $1 million loan or $1,050,000 loan. And that can come in handy if you're almost to that price point where you want to buy, but you're slightly outside that.
And that's one of the big differences between the temporary buy-down and the permanent buy-down. With the temporary buy-down, you're qualifying at the full rate. With the permanent buy-down, you're qualifying at whatever you discount that rate to. So essentially, you can get more loan, buy more house, get a better location, get a home in better condition, whatever it is, because you are able to purchase more house, as opposed to stretching perhaps at the full rate to qualify.
Exactly. And that fifth difference in, say, $50,000 purchase price might be the difference in you liking, you know, the price of the home and the area that you want to buy versus not. So sometimes it does come in handy. Okay. Talking about for sellers, this is really directed towards sellers, and it's seller concessions. And it's really like, how do you want to spend the money if you're going to discount, if you're going to give credits, and things like that. So we'll talk about a couple of the options, and every situation is different. Never one is right for one person, may not be right for the other. So that's really where it comes down to strategizing with your lender and your realtor to find out what is best for you. But in general terms, a seller buy-down credit can provide more value for a buyer than a price reduction. We've talked a little bit about that already. An example: if you did a $16,000 seller credit and you bought the interest rate down, that might save you $54,000 over the course of 10 years on that particular mortgage. Again, the preference that I used before is, if you stay in that loan for a long time, which it's possible, if the rates bought down enough, maybe rates don't get much better. It's hard to know. We think they're going to get better a year or two from now, but there's no guarantee of that based on some of the strange things we've seen recently. So the idea being is, a $16,000 seller credit can buy down the rate enough to where you're going to save $54,000 over 10 years. Well, that was certainly better off for everybody. It's better off for the seller. It's also better off for the buyer.
Yeah, so in other words, if you're buying the house and you're approaching the seller and they're asking $900,000 for the house, instead of trying to get the price down to $850,000, you offer to pay their price if they'll give you the credit to buy down the rate. And in the long run, the buyer ends up with lower interest rate, lower interest expense, and a lower monthly payment. And the longer you keep the loan, the more you win, right?
Exactly. And like I said, I mean, we think rates are going to get better, but there's really no guarantee of that fact. I mean, one would think so, but we're also leaning toward a little bit higher inflation culture compared to what we've had the last 10, 20 years. If it does stay that way, then rates will stay higher. A buy-down credit incentive for a competitive advantage, meaning an effective strategy for selling a home in a rising interest rate environment, is those credits can perhaps make someone that really wants to buy but is scared of these higher interest rates, an interest rate incentive will say, okay, you know what, that makes the difference for me wanting to buy or qualifying, which we referenced earlier.
Right. And so you'll see later in the presentation, we're going to go through some slides that show you what happened last year with interest rates as we went through the year. In the beginning of the year, rates were closer to 3%. By the time we got to June, they crossed 6%. And as we went to the second half of the year, the market slowed down substantially. And one of the ways that we were bringing buyers back into the market, sellers are offering to buy down the interest rate as an incentive. And the sellers that weren't offering that, some of them didn't sell, and the ones that did got their houses sold.
Exactly. And this last item is definitely for sellers and for sellers that have owned their home a long time. Thinking about a discount, a lot of times it's like, I don't want to discount $50,000 because you feel like you're losing $50,000 because you own your own outright or you've owned it for a very long time. However, because you do pay capital gain, especially on some of the gains for so many people in the Bay Area, their homes have gone up so much in the last 30, 40 years, that the last part of your gain you may be to be paying taxes on anyway, in which case you're going to pay taxes of 20 to 30%. So on a $50,000 discount, you may actually really only be giving away $35,000 in the term of, you know, so it's a good thing to remember the tax implication both on the other side of the gains you're going to make.
Yeah, it's the net after tax that you want to focus on as a seller, and selling expenses are typically a write-off. Broker fees, sometimes fix-up fees, incentive credits to the buyer, all those things fall into that bucket, and that can help reduce your capital gain exposure.
Exactly. All right, so rate buy-down credit versus price reduction. This kind of puts in terms, I won't dive into the numbers too much because there's a lot there, but in essence, when you look at it, if you see a buy-down, you know, if a $1.5 million purchase versus lowering the purchase price $50,000 versus using $50,000 in discounts on points, you'll find a couple things, but ultimately the point cost is less than the discount, but ultimately the payment is also lower in this scenario. So as a seller, you've spent less money in giving a discount, and at the same time the buyer is actually more afforded, meaning they're better off in terms of a monthly payment and both of what they can qualify for that particular transaction.
And usually if your house isn't selling and it's related to the price being too high or the market softening or there's a lot of inventory that you're competing with, to make a price change where when you're priced at $1.5 million, less than $50,000, it really doesn't even put it on a different shelf competitively. You're almost wasting your time lowering it at all. It's either a minimum of 50 every time you lower it. So sometimes instead of falling into that trap, offering that incentive to the buyer for the buy down can make the difference and preserve the price that you get for the house.
Exactly. Okay, we've talked a little bit about this so far. A seller buy-down credit can reduce the seller's capital gain income tax. And loan discount points paid by the buyer are tax deductible. Obviously, we tell you to talk to your CPA, but discount points or points up front, permanent buy-down, it's referenced a lot of different ways, is an interest. It's like prepaying interest only on the whole loan versus a temporary year or two. And tax code is generally says that because it's interest you're paying, it's considered a tax deductible event for that tax year. All right, adjustable rate loans. This is important because in an environment like 2001, we knew we were at historically low interest rates, you want to do a 30-year fixed because historically it's the best it's ever been. It's worth the risk. Since we've gone up so much in interest rate, meaning we wiped out 10 to 15 years of lower interest rates in just 6 months, it's logical to think that in 7 to 10 years from now, interest rates will be better and or you'll move or whatever the case might be, and you can save quite a bit of money by doing a 5, 7, or 10 year fixed ARM, which is adjustable rate mortgage abbreviation. How does it work? So in the first 7 years, I think we use 7 years as a product that's very common because an economic cycle tends to be 7 years. And the question is always, what happens in year eight? And essentially is a margin plus an index. If you refinance, which you're able to do anytime in that first 7 years, if you sell your home, in any case, then the year eight becomes irrelevant. We might see low interest rates in 4 years. Then you refinance 4 years from now into whatever product will most serve you. But the idea being is the index is margin plus index. If that adjusted today, the rate would probably be higher than the 7 year fixed rate today. Everything's secured by the SOFR index, which as you can see up here is the secure overnight financing rate. It's a new index, however, it tends to be a slower moving index, but it does move sort of in conjunction with what the Federal Reserve does, but not exactly. Talking about more of the advantages. You can be a short-term owner or you can be a long-term owner. I've seen owners live in their homes for 25 years and they've done an ARM product starting 20 years ago and up until 2 years ago because it was just always beneficial. And there's always some time in that 7 to 10 year period where you can adjust your rate, refinance, and it always makes sense. Sometimes it's a function of you're going to get a pay raise. You're like, okay, I'm going to be more flexible today, but when I make more, I'm willing to pay a higher interest rate because it just seems more logical. More purchasing power. I think this is the one that tends to be the biggest right now. If you say a 7 year fixed versus a 30 year fixed, that could be a difference of 0.5% in interest rate. Well, 0.5% in interest rate on a 5.5% rate is almost 10%. Well, that means you can afford 10% more if your interest rate is 10% lower, and that's a big factor in this current, you know, situation where rates have gone up and home values are still pretty pricey. Anything to add, Pete?
Yes. Okay.
Buying your next home first, using your home equity. These situations can be complex, so I won't go into too many details because when in this situation, everyone's situation is slightly different. Some people have saved the cash, they need some equity from their home, they've saved some money and it's in the bank. Some can afford both homes in one fashion or another for a period of time. Some can, some can't. Some are scared to do that because they don't want to own two homes at once. Every single buyer situation is very different, and that's when, if you're in this situation and you want to be in this situation, because it is a great convenience as well to not have to move really fast and move into a new home. But we'll talk about some of those options real quick. If you have enough equity, income, and reserves to qualify, getting a line of credit on your existing home is a way to get some of that down payment. Buying your next home with all cash. That is an option, but maybe long-term you really do want to have a mortgage. We can do that, and there's programs specifically to help someone refinance a home after they've paid cash. Why do it with all cash? Less competition, less contingencies, more competitiveness. If we get to a really aggressive buyer's market again, that'll come in handy as well.
Well, that can also be getting your equity out of the house and then to becoming an all-cash buyer with that equity, right?
Yeah, exactly. And again, that comes into personal preference. Some people want to sell their home, cash out, so they know exactly what they're dealing with and be aggressive in that buyer. And everybody's situation is a little different based on their risk tolerance. The key, though, in any of this is talk to a realtor and a lender from the very beginning because they'll give you good advice.
Right. So we help with analyzing what we think your house would be worth in today's market, and then that helps figure out, you know, your essential equity position. And then from there, you reach out to the lender and you go into your qualifying, what's required, and reserves and income, debt-to-income ratios, all those things.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. You want to take this?
Yeah. So these are the pros and cons of buying your next home first and then selling the home that you have. The primary benefit is you eliminate the sale of property contingency. So if you think for a second, when you're bringing an offer in on a seller's home, what you're really asking them to do is to take their house off the market if they accept your offer and wait for you to get through the escrow period and clear all of your contingencies so that you can close and then they can move. And if you have that one contingency about selling your home, there's a lot of risk of that for the seller that you're asking them to accept, meaning they have no control over if your house sells, when it sells, all those things. And what if you do sell it during the escrow period and then it falls apart and now we're back to square one? So home sale contingencies are not really favorable for the seller, especially when there's when the market's heating up and it's competitive. It's almost impossible to get an offer like that accepted. So keep that in mind. The pros for the buyer is that it strengthens your negotiating position when the market's competitive, a seller's market. You can come in without that contingency to sell your home. You know where you're moving and how soon you're going to take possession. That's a big one for a lot of people. Most people don't want to let go of what they have and sell and move until they know where they're going. It's really unnerving for a lot of folks to put their house for sale, find a buyer, go into escrow, and now they start house hunting and hoping they can get the next house and the right house in a very short, compressed amount of time before they have to move out of the home they just sold. So for practical reasons, buying first and then selling takes that off the table, makes it far more certain for the seller because they already have acquired the house, they know where they're going, and the timing can be figured out in a way that they're not making a double move because they didn't get it right. So timing the sale, avoiding the double move, no contingency to sell, stronger negotiating position. These are all really compelling reasons to try to find a way to buy first and then sell. The cons would be, you know, you're purchasing with all cash without, you know, financing. It ties up your resources. You have two houses. You have the one you just bought and the one you need to sell. If the market's strong, though, you know your house is going to sell. So usually this strategy is done during a period where the market's strong enough where that's not an issue. So you do have carrying costs for the two homes until you can sell your current home, right? Isn't that how you look at qualifying for this?
Yeah, definitely. We look at qualifying for both homes. There is a couple programs that exist to help offset some of that expense. So you are capable more than perhaps you would. So if both home payments, taxes, insurance, you know, say added up to $10,000 or $15,000, we're not going to count that entire $10,000 or $15,000 against you because we know some of it's temporary. Mm-hmm. And being, you know, at Golden One Credit Union, because we hold and service all the loans we originate, then we can kind of do things our way, if you will.
But so you have more flexibility than the traditional institutional lender?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right, creative financing before you're selling your next home. So we talked a little about, just briefly, about how do you put together the finances to buy before you sell. And there's really three primary ways. And they're kind of listed in order of expense. And it's very general, but the idea is if you can afford, essentially it's if you can naturally afford with your normal income and normal assets to do a buy before sell, then the first options are always better. Borrowing an equity line, doing an equity line on your departure residence to free up extra capital for the down payment, and then pooling any other cash that you have and create a down payment on a purchase of a new home. The good news is, at least with Golden One, we have some pretty flexible programs to where we, in most cases, you don't need 20% down payment on the new home. So you don't necessarily have to borrow too much from your existing home in order to accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. And those can be, these equity lines can be in a first and or second position, which means if you own your own home outright, then it's easy to borrow from your home and use that capital to buy your next home. Cross-collateralization is when we get a little more creative. And those situations where you're taking one loan, the interest rates are a little bit higher, and it's secured by more than one property, meaning in essence, they're going to use all of the equity in your home to help offset the total loan to value of your new purchase. In these scenarios, sometimes you don't need to come in with any of your own cash. The cash or the quote-unquote down payment is really just the equity from your current home. As you can see, though, these interest rates are pretty high, and sometimes it's worth it for that short period of time to pay that higher interest rate to successfully move before you buy, move, and then sell your other house.
Well, I mean, that's the key here, really. It's the interest rate is higher, but it's temporary.
Yeah.
And once everything is done, you've bought the next house, you've sold the last one, then that loan goes away, and now you have your permanent loan in place at whatever the market rate is, right?
Exactly. And I think the best way to look at it is a convenience fee. And how much is it worth for this convenience? And, you know, every transaction is a little bit different in terms of what that total number is, but that's ultimately what it is.
And sometimes if the market's really hot, it's the only way you can get the next house. And it becomes more than a convenience in some ways, it becomes a necessity to be able to buy that house without having that contingency and being a non-competitive buyer.
Yeah, and then there is another way to look at that as well, and it is, okay, if I come in with this special financing that's expensive, but it's very flexible and it lets me do what I want to do, then maybe I can make an offer without a contingency in one form or another. Therefore, I might pay a little bit less because I'm not having to come in with contingencies. So if you're able to save $20,000, $30,000 in the purchase price because your offer gets accepted with a more, you know, firm offer, then it's almost like it's paying for itself. The last option, private money, it's the most flexible. Really, it's almost fully loan-to-value driven and not where the money's coming from for the down payment, but the interest rates are higher and they range from, you know, almost 10% to 12%.
But in that case, isn't it true that the borrower's qualifications are less meaningful than the equity position that's securing the loan? Is that true?
It's really, almost all private money is underwritten almost solely against loan to value.
Yeah.
So where it's really beneficial is you have, you know, you own your home outright, especially for a downsizing person. You own your home, it's worth $1.5 million and you're trying to downsize to $700,000 and you have, you know, over $1 million in equity in your current home and you want to make a cash offer on that $700,000 house, a private lender will give you all $700,000. And you can just buy your house, move, and then fix up your current home and sell it.
Or if you're self-employed, those are trickier folks to qualify for, right? There's more documentation involved, and it's complicated. So that could be another reason to go with private money financing.
Exactly. And it, for me, you know, being in a credit union, we certainly don't do loans like this. However, when I come across someone that's in that situation, you know, I'll recommend a couple different private lenders where I know they get treated fairly, but, you know, at that point I can't do anything for you, but I'll steer you in the right direction.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that if that's something, if all these things a lender provides, or if you have to go elsewhere too.
Yeah, it's hard for a regular consumer to chase options 2 and 3, cross-collateralizing loans and private money loans, and you never know whether you're going to get a fair deal or not. And just having known that market and been around in the industry for so long, I'll know where to send you so you're not getting charged unfairly, because that does happen.
Right, yeah, I've navigated that market recently for my own account with investment properties, and it took me a while to become knowledgeable about what was really a fair deal rather than one that was usurious, I should say. But I was thankful I had those options, and if you can find the right one out there, they can be the perfect product for what you need.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Why so much home price volatility? We've had interest rate volatility. Obviously, we saw really, really low rates in the early part of 22, and then all of a sudden, we're having interest rates that are similar to 1997 or 1998. The government stimulus. It doesn't matter really which side of the red or blue you fall on. We've given away a lot of money as a congressional stimulus and pandemic effect, and the Federal Reserve stimulus, which is tied to the bond market and interest rates and the Federal Reserve enhancing their balance sheet. And we'll really recap things with excessive money, M2 money supply. It's something that doesn't get talked about a lot in the news, because news is really about, you know, 30 second to 1 minute sound bites, and talking about the M2 money supply is not something you can sort of just talk about for 30 seconds. But in essence, and I'll show you some information in a second, when this happens and the way the government stimulated this time versus the Great Recession in 2008, this time the money supply exploded, the last time it didn't, and that's why we really saw the inflation. Yes, inflation was created somewhat by, you know, supply chain, but if you see some of the charts we're about to talk about, you'll see it kind of all makes sense. Okay, and this really talks to the affordability of housing. This first slide is just look at interest rate. If you look at this chart, you'll see that we were looking at 3.5% interest rates in the first part of 2022. And now we've grown to, you know, rates that are more around 5.5%, let's say, in the jumbo category. Just looking at the similar payments, you can see that just the interest rate makes you afford 20% less house.
So in other words, if the payment remains constant and the rate goes up, then the mortgage amount drops substantially. It goes from over $1 million to $800,000 when the rates go up by 2%.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if you say, okay, well, why did home prices come down, you know, 10 or 15%? I think the way to look at this is not everyone is buying at their maximum that they can qualify for. So there's going to be a little bit of play in that 21% number in terms of homes becoming 21% less affordable. It doesn't mean that everyone was at their max, therefore home prices didn't drop 21%, but why they dropped 10% so quickly can be seen as simply as just the interest rates alone. Okay, so these are some things. When you watch the news, you'll generally say, well, the reason that this happened is because of this, or the reason that this happened is because of that. And the answer is it's a little bit of all of them. And I've tried to recap this so you can see some of the trends and how the timing was all somewhat similar. And the financial stimulus made the money supply increase, thus asset prices increases. The best way to look at that is there's more and more dollars, meaning if we increase the U.S. M2 money supply by 40% in 2 years, I know that seems crazy, and it is, usually the money supply goes up about 5 or 6% a year. It went up 40% in 2 years. Well, now you have more dollars chasing the same amount of things, whether it's houses, stocks, furniture, you name it. It's everything. So stock prices between January 20 and January 22 went up 47%. Bond values up 20% from January 20 to 21 and then back down again. We'll talk a little more about that. Bay Area property values increased 30 to 45% in that same two-year period. I think you see the trend I'm trying to paint here. Mm-hmm. It's not really an accident that all these things happen at the same time. And the M2 money supply, as I mentioned, grew 40% in that 2 years, and normal is 6 to 7%. That increase of over $5 trillion, to put that in perspective, before the pandemic, our money supply was at $14 trillion, which means we went from 14 to over 20 in 2 years. And previously, the money supply was, you know, growing ever so small every single month. So where do we go from here? The money supply needs a return to normal trend, and that is starting. We are starting that process. So when you see the Federal Reserve and the chairman doing what he's doing and raising interest rates, and they're also weaning their balance sheet, you'll see that, you know, this has started, and I'll talk a little bit to that. Just for some basics, sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words, as they say. If you look at a trend of just the S&P stock market, you can see in normal years, 2019, that's a much flatter curve than we started seeing when the pandemic hit. You don't even have to get into what the numbers say, but it's pretty obvious that it started going up at a much faster pace than normal. Well, this is a 35-year chart or 40-year chart of that same trend. And as you can see, it was always much flatter until the last couple of years. So when the stock market started coming down, people, you know, in general, the news was talking a lot about, oh my gosh, there should be panic, the stock market is dropping. And one could argue, well, the stock market maybe is just going back to normal. Okay, treasury prices. So this is a five-year chart, and this just speaks to, we're a little above normal right now, but not that much above normal in terms of treasuries. But we went really below normal for a period of time during the pandemic, and now we've raised really fast. The news, of course, everything in the news right now is talking about Silicon Valley Bank and the impact it's had on regional banks. This chart is really a direct representation of what has happened to them. I will not today, however, talk about all the details that went into that, though I could, simply because it's long and it's drawn out and it's somewhat complicated. But this divergence in yields actually is one of the critical things that Silicon Valley Bank did not prepare for and didn't plan for, and it essentially took their company down.
Probably not the only bank out there that didn't prepare.
Yeah, you know, they didn't hedge their portfolio at all, which hurt them more. And they didn't respond to, you know, in essence, every bank bought a bunch of treasuries or gave out a bunch of mortgages or whatever, really, really low interest rates. And what happens to a bond price is when you, if you invest in a treasury bond, let's say you're, you know, an everyday consumer and you buy a 10-year treasury that was a 1.5% a couple years ago. Well, now that that treasury is, say, 3.5%, if you paid $10,000 for that particular bond, well, today that bond may only be worth $8,000, which you thought it was safe because it's a U.S. Treasury. Someday in the future, meaning if you hold it for that whole 10 years, it will go back up to $10,000, but you have to wait that entire period of time. So, home prices. I pulled a home that I know had sold a couple times, and so we could kind of somewhat feel like the trend is real. So if the trend line was above the sales price, you know, in 2014, the idea is we see the big spike. When the money supply spiked, which I mentioned from January 20 to January 22, well, and it sold again, the same home did, we know that's real. It really did sell for that higher price. This chart is realistic, but abnormal compared to normal. And if you look at so many home price trends, they're going to look just like this. Okay, here's a drill down in the money supply. A 10-year-old could probably look at this chart and say, what happened? Why did it go up so much? But you can see that we had a very calm money supply trend line going from 2018 to 2020, pretty flat. And it spiked in that six-month period, and then it sort of became sort of a normal trend upward, but a slightly higher trend line than before. And now you can see for the first time since the Great Depression, the money supply is dropping. From 2022 till now, it is going down. That needs to happen so we can get to the long-term trend, in essence, going back to that original trend exactly. So as Pete draws the little pointer, what does it really mean? We're about 2 years ahead of where we should be in the money supply. That's why everything's still very expensive, and why the economy's still roaring, even though interest rates are high. As things moderate, everything will moderate. The goal of the Federal Reserve is to try to have it moderate in a painless way. The question is whether they can accomplish that. This just zooms in a little bit on a two-year chart. It gives you a little more substantiated view of how much it was going up and then how much it was going down. And this chart, which will be hard to see from this, but it just speaks to, it gives you an index line of how much the money supply was going up a little bit each month and then how it just exploded. Okay, so where do we go from here? That's the real question. As long as employment stays strong, a major recession is unlikely. The other thing I'd like to say is we talk and you see on the news, recession, 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 the R, whatever you're calling it, the R word. Think about it this way, so you can be more calm about everything. Currently, if we grow at 2% a year, and then all of a sudden we're not growing at 0.5% a year. So as an example, you used to make $100,000 a year, and now you make $99,500 a year. Is that really gonna change what happens to the average consumer? Probably not. Well, that's still a recession in terms of income. If we have a very moderate recession, it should be very, it should be almost like a non-event. However, we talk about it in the news so much that it's going to be this scary boogeyman. And I would just say that the Federal Reserve, they're raising rates to slow the economy. If we get to a recessionary stance, the Federal Reserve will stop raising rates and probably lower rates. And when they do that, they'll be able to moderate any impact of a recession. So I just don't think we need to worry about it too much. Interest rates start to go lower as inflation moderates, meaning 3% mortgage rates are not likely in the future, like we had in 2021 and part of 22. But do we go away from, you know, depending on the loan product, between 5.5% and 6.5% and go back to something more normal, which generally speaking, for the last 10 years, we've been between 4 and 5. I think that becomes more normal, but that doesn't happen until we get inflation down to closer to 2%.
Well, I think part of the problem is that interest rates were at 3% for too long.
Yes.
And now we're paying the price to try to rein all of that in. And had they slowly risen to par, which is probably closer to 5 than 3, we might not be in the predicament we're in now, where we're up against the wall when trying to get this genie back in the bottle, I guess, right, and control it?
It was really a confluence of really bad timing for everything that was going on, meaning our government decided to give another round of COVID stimulus in October of 21, I believe it was. And there was already serious signs of inflation. So there was definitely certain people in our economy that were impacted by COVID and needed help. And they kind of gave away a lot of money. As opposed to being targeted, it was broad like it had been, yet the economy was already exploding and we were getting revenge spending, meaning we were locked up, we couldn't go anywhere, we couldn't buy anything, we couldn't do anything, which means for many people, they were able to save money. So now that they've saved money, okay, I want to spend some of this money, I want to get out of my house and go do something. And that all happened at the same time. And the Federal Reserve just responded too slowly. And it probably optically, they don't talk about it in this news at all, but if the Federal Reserve had raised rates in October at the same time Congress was giving away $600 billion for COVID, the optics on that would not look very good. And as much as we want to feel that the Fed isn't political, it's a little political.
Yeah, right.
Home prices will tend to stay steady, not much up, not much down. I think that's probably where we are for a little bit, meaning that we'll kind of hover where we are. Prices are not going to see the downside like we saw in the Great Recession. And I think that's a statistical impossibility, especially based on how we've underwritten loans for the last 10 years. And I think, you know, if we're going to be moderated by the Fed, a phrase I like to use, whether you're a NASCAR fan and you're into, you know, notice restrictor plate racing, or you've been in a golf cart going downhill and it's electric and the brakes go on automatically, it's just we're going to be moderated. And it's, we're going to have to stay in this very slow range of economic growth. And I think that's going to keep housing prices stable and not a lot up and not a lot down. This is a big one. And this was not true during the Great Recession. And I would say home prices are supported by a demographic tailwind. I would say not even just 30 to 35, but I would almost modify that to 30 to 40. There's more 30 to 40-year-olds today than normal. They tend to be first-time home buyers, and first-time home buyers nowadays tend to be, you know, some expensive homes in some cases. There's more of them now than normal, which means there's more people that, you know, family formation, wanting to buy their first home, and that's going to be supportive of home prices. And then the Federal Reserve, they will stay on the same path. They're continuing to reduce their balance sheet. They're going to continue to keep the money supply slightly flat to down as long as they can. And at some point, they'll let things go. And I think 2024, we will see a more normal inflation. There's a chance that it stretches to 2025. But I think 2024 is probably more likely. Deep down, the Federal Reserve wants lower interest rates. This is an important point. Everything that happened to Silicon Valley Bank in terms of their bond portfolio is also happening to the Federal Reserve. They have over $8 trillion of bonds on their balance sheet that have lost value, a lot of value. Those go back up in value when rates go down. So they don't want rates to be this way. It just needs to be this way to get inflation under control.
Well, that was part of their stimulus from the Great Recession, is discounted interest rates to get the economy going after the meltdown and Lehman Brothers imploding and all the things that happened back in the day. It was designed to be temporary, short term. It turned out to be a decade instead of 2 to 3 years. And they were the biggest buyer in the bond market, right? And
by far, yeah. During the pandemic, they were by far the biggest buyer. Their balance sheet went from roughly $3.6 trillion to over $8 trillion.
So, yeah, there's a relationship of interest rates to the bond, the price of bond, the yields of bonds. And so when you buy a lot of bonds and you make the market, if you will, rates drop.
Yeah, and they did do that on purpose. They wanted rates to drop. So they, in essence, were buying everything. And the world knew it, and that's why we saw price yields go down or interest rates drop so much so fast. And now we're sort of seeing the other side of that.
Okay, so we wanted to share with you the different types of real estate markets, market trends, actually, and how to spot them, how to know what market you're in if you're deciding to buy or sell. And one of the benchmarks is for a buyer's market is the amount of supply is more than 6 months of inventory based on the number of closed sales. So when you have that much supply or more than 6 months, typically the demand is low. You've got a lot of houses for sale. Homes are sitting around for a lengthy period of time. The days on market can be a month, two, or three. You'll see a lot of price concessions and other concessions from a seller to get the houses to sell. In contrast to a seller's market, which is the one that we've been in for probably 10 years, I would say 8 to 10 years since the government decided to drop rates or make the rates drop, the inventory's been excessively low. And that coupled with more demand in the market, meaning what you just said a minute ago, a whole demographic finally come of age and started entering the housing market, trailing the boomer market. So the supply would be less than 3 months of inventory based on closed sales. And a neutral market is somewhere in between that. A neutral market is somewhere between 3 to 6 months of inventory based on closed sales. And a neutral market happens to be my favorite market. And the reason I say that is that there's balance. Neither party has the advantage over the other. And it just feels a lot more like the negotiations and the transactions are evenly weighted. You don't have buyers coming in a seller's market making these crazy overbids, no contingencies in their offer, all cash, free rent, you name it, right, Leslie? I mean, we've seen a crazy amount of that going on in the last 2 to 3 years, especially during the pandemic, and we're going to show you why in a minute. And it's not heavily weighted in favor of the buyer either, like it is in a buyer's market. So in 2000, let's see, what was it, 7 or 8? Probably 2008 was the bottom, when everything really went to hell in a handbasket, so to speak.
Yes. Started in 2008, maybe ended around 2010 or 11.
Yeah, it took 3 years for it to work through that. We had a lot of supply of distressed inventory, as well as homeowners just trying to sell during all of that. So remember the days of the short sales and the bank-owned REO properties, foreclosures? That was almost at least half the market in our area. And there are some parts of California where it was almost the entire market of available inventory. In places like Phoenix and Las Vegas, 70-80% of every house that was sold was a distressed sale. In that environment, the buyer definitely has the upper hand. And they get price concessions, repair concessions, anything you want. They'll do just about whatever it takes to get the house sold, whether it's the bank or the seller.
Exactly.
So it helps to know the trend that you're in. And so for a buyer's market, what you're looking for is the increasing supply of homes for sale, meaning active listings. If you're noticing a trend that over each month, the supply of homes in the area that you own a home or you're looking to buy a home begins to increase, that's the first sign of a buyer's market. And then you're also going to notice the days on market, the time they're sitting around is increasing too, right?
Yeah.
Last year, we saw that change. When June came around, it was this overheated seller's market, and houses were selling in a matter of days, in some cases hours, right? And then June comes around, everything comes to a screeching halt, and suddenly houses are sitting around for what felt like an eternity, which in California is 3 to 4 weeks. And other parts of the country, they're happy if your house sells in 3 to 4 months. Out here, we're used to this really fast-paced, crazy volume. So you're looking for an increase in the days on market, low buyer demand, meaning the number of pending sales is low compared to the amount of active homes for sale. And then seller concessions, you're seeing price drops, credits, concessions, that type of thing. And then on the seller's market, it's the flip side of that. The supply is decreasing. Fewer homes for sale, days on market less than 3 weeks, high buyer demand, meaning the number of pending sales relative to the active listings is keeping pace with the homes for sale. And then you'll see the multiple offers, overbidding, as is sales with no concessions. So I wanted to show you some charts here to help you make sense of where we've been and where we are right now. So, oh, we went backwards a slide. That's okay. Okay. Yeah, if you could shut that, that would be great. So what you're seeing is a chart. This data comes right out of the local multiple listing. It's a very simple bar graph. It shows you the number of homes that are for sale each month, which would be these light green bars. It shows you the number of homes that actually sold and closed each month. And then this red line that goes over these bars, that's the number of pending sales that happened each month. So this was 2019 for Central Contra Costa County. And this will give you an example of pre-pandemic, what the market looked like before things changed dramatically. So you'll see that the supply of homes, these numbers were higher than the number of pending sales each month. But they weren't, it was a normal, this is what I would call more of a balanced market. And as we got towards the tail end of 2019, you'll see that this red line was very close to the green bar. In some cases, it was above it. The market was starting to heat up towards the end of 2019. And so that's where we were pre-pandemic, before all kinds of stimulus was applied to the economy to change a lot of things. So if you want to go to the next one. So this is 2020, and this is... We just came out of the end of 2019, and you can see that the supply was low, which it normally is in the first few months of the year, and the demand is there to meet it. It's almost right there with the supply, and then the pandemic hits in March, and we had this as you can tell, supply keeps going, was growing, and then the demand falls way off. And part of that was due to the fact that we couldn't figure out if we were allowed to sell homes at that. In the early days of the pandemic, real estate sales and realtors weren't recognized as a necessary business. And so it was actually technically, remember, we couldn't sell, show homes. We had all those restrictions.
Yes.
Right. We had to get creative with finding ways to show homes. It was illegal to show a home that was occupied for a couple of months. We could only show vacant homes. And then we had all these restrictions. We had all these crazy forms we had to fill out, right? And hand sanitizer, masks, all the things that we had to do to comply with the health and safety issues, okay? So then what happened when we figured out that we were now allowed to sell homes and we could actually show occupied homes, show and sell occupied homes, we saw that the demand started to go up. People jumped back in the market. You can see the supply was limited relative to the demand. And as we proceeded through 2020, what you were also seeing, and some of the things that the government was doing to stimulate the economy. And so this is what happened with the pandemic in the early days. And if you go to 2021, this is the definition of a white hot, overheated seller's market. So you can see the green bars here is inventory, very, very low. Look at the demand. I mean, anything that came on the market would sell, and it would sell quickly. And so we had this crazy run-up in real estate values in 2021. And then if you move into 2022, you'll see that this is a continuous, frenetic dynamic until we get to about the middle of the year, which is June. But you can see that the supply was extremely low relative to demand. While this was happening here, we went from 3% to 6% in the first 6 months in interest rates. We also saw appreciation on the average in this area of about 25% in 6 months. So to put that in perspective, if you go back 40 or 50 years, we average about 5% a year in appreciation, no matter what, if you just go out that timeline. And to go up 25% in 6 months was phenomenal. It was not sustainable, and it ultimately shifted. And so this is when rates started to spike. You can see the inventory was growing and the demand fell way off. So here's where we are in 2023. So this is the tail end of last year as we come out of the gate into 2023. And it's beginning to look a lot like it did in 2019 before all that stimulus was applied to offset the COVID, the demand, or the pandemic, and all the things that we were coping with then. So we're seeing a much more normal, balanced market. It's still weighted in favor of the seller because the supply is low, but the demand is coming back, even though rates have risen. They've also tempered a bit, too.
Yeah, Pete, I'll jump in on that, too. We forget, but if you Google taper tantrum, in 2018, that was a thing. It was a phrase that was talked about raising interest rates and the Fed easing off on their balance sheet or starting to sell off their assets and made interest rates go up a little. I mean, a really little in today's comparison terms. But what happened is housing prices started to weaken in the late 2018 timeline. And it was at that point where the Fed tried to take that $4 trillion balance sheet down to 3.6 is as far as they got. And then they had to, you know, ease off in essence and let the market act normal with that balance sheet. And that's when you saw the 2019 be kind of a more normal balanced market. And I think that's probably what we're going into. So your conclusion about 19, there are some similarities even in terms of what the Federal Reserve has been doing.
Yeah, I think all of this points that we're slowly, you know, going back to normal. And it feels like from where we were at these elevated highs, like something's off. But really, we're just kind of getting back to where we should be without the excessive stimulus to the economy and the real estate market. So the trickiest market to be in is a market that's transitioning from one trend to another, meaning like last year as an example. We went from this white-hot, overheated seller's market for the first six months, and then we transitioned very quickly to a much different market where it wasn't in favor of the seller so much. And the problem with that transitional market is the expectations of the buyer and the seller. After things begin to shift, you have sellers still thinking it's the way it was a few months earlier, chasing those prices that aren't there because buyers know it's different. They're not willing to pay those prices. Plus, the cost of paying those prices is a lot higher because the rates are so much higher. So it takes time to work through that transition period where the rules of engagement become agreed upon between both parties. And now I can say that after 6 months of an adjustment from June of last year to the beginning of this year, I think most sellers that are on the market today understand that this isn't what it was a year ago, and they have to be more realistic in the price that they can get. And we've seen real estate values drop from the peak of last year. But basically, the values are about where they were a year ago. So essentially, they went up 25% in 6 months. We gave it all back. And now if we look at what things were selling for a year ago, that's pretty much what your house is going to be worth today, which is not a bad thing because we got to that price from about 9 or 10 years of this really strong level of appreciation. So it's still a good value range. So what are the next steps? We have a home consultation questionnaire if you're interested. We also can schedule a one-on-one meeting. We can go over your specific needs and what your goals are and see if we can make things work for you in the way of financing options, and we can help you get the highest price based on what's going on in the market. And Bill can help you with the loan side of it.
Yeah, and I would say too, if you're a seller and you are going to obviously talk with Pete, and let's say about what's... I lost my train of thought. I know what I was going to say. You're going to talk to them about you selling your house, but you still may also want to get some information on the mortgage market and what's going on. And even if you're not looking to buy another house, I'm still willing to help, because it's all about how this team can help you and feel comfortable with what you're trying to accomplish.
Thanks, Bill.
Yeah, and we have a philosophy of leading with the lending with our clients, because it's one thing to know what your house is worth and talk about the kind of house you'd like to buy and all those great things. But to know what your financing options are can really make a huge difference. And understanding the benefit of buying down the interest rate, whether or not it's a buyer's or seller's market or rates are high or rates are low, I think there's an advantage to buying down the rate regardless. If you're going to hold that loan for 7+ years or more, if you do the math, there's a huge savings in it for you as the borrower to do that.
True. And there's a lot of online tools to find a mortgage, which is sort of cookie cutter, but oftentimes everybody has their own personal circumstance. In that case, it's much better to talk to an actual human and get some different scenarios.
Yeah, and I'll end with one thing too. There's been a change in the mortgage market in the last 6 months. There was a time when independent mortgage companies, whether it's a big brokerage, a national brokerage, and what have you, would be a place that would be a great place to look for a loan. With this disjointed fixed income market has come a trend where credit union like Golden One, that's a nonprofit, is anywhere from 0.5% to 1%, believe it or not, better on a jumbo loan than every independent mortgage company in America. And it didn't used to be that way. So even if you've got existing relationships, you should definitely talk to more than one person, because what used to be isn't necessarily how it is today.
Yeah, I would say that it's well worth your time to compare what a credit union can offer compared to the more traditional lenders in the marketplace. And that goes for more than just home loans. I recently bought a new car and I started shopping around and I discovered that I couldn't beat the credit union's rate. I joined a credit union and I got an excellent rate for the car, and also it works with home loan financing as well.
Yeah, I kind of liken Golden One to, if you're a football fan or a fan, San Francisco 49er fan, Brock Purdy. No one knew who he was. No one knew how good he was until he actually played.
And then
once he played after a week or two, well, you know, they got a really good team. And then after 5, 6, 7 games, like, wow, this kid's really good. And having been with, you know, been a big institutional bank and now with a credit union, they truly do some special things, and you just got to give us a try and you'll see.
Great. Well, thank you, Bill, for joining us. Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me.